on these tapes is the Deaver-Till debate. This was a public oral debate between Mac Deaver and Farrell Till. The debate was March 25th through the 28th, 1991, on the campus of Southwest Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas. The first two nights, the following proposition was discussed. Resolved, the alleged moral atrocities ascribed to God of the Bible are not actual moral atrocities and, therefore, constitute no proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. Affirming was Mac Deaver, denying was Farrell Till. The last two nights, the following proposition was discussed. The alleged moral atrocities ascribed to the God of the Bible are actual moral atrocities and, therefore, constitute proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. Affirming Farrell Till and denying Mac Deaver. At the beginning of the tape, Mr. John Moore is introducing Mac Deaver.
The AA degree from Fort Worth Christian College, the BA degree from Oklahoma Christian College, and the MA degree from Harding Graduate School. He's taught in preacher training schools and in the Tennessee Bible College in Cooksville, Tennessee. He's also worked as the local preacher for several congregations among the Churches of Christ. He is a resident of Austin, Texas, and is currently engaged in speaking on numerous lectureships, debates, and meetings, as well as working as the associate editor of a publication known as Biblical Notes. Denying the proposition that's been stated tonight will be Mr. Farrell Till of Canton, Illinois. He holds both the bachelor's and master's degree from Harding University. As a former preacher for Churches of Christ, Mr. Till worked among various congregations until 1965. And since that time, he's been an instructor of English at Spoon River College in Canton, Illinois. He also is currently engaged in public and written debates on the topic that we are discussing tonight. He's also also the publisher and editor of a quarterly journal known as the Skeptical Review. Now, the rules for tonight's debate, which have been agreed upon by both participants, are as follows. And both of these men have seen these rules and have signed them and agreed to follow by these rules, and I will read them for you. Each speaker, when in the affirmative, is to be careful to state the issue clearly and to define the terms of his proposition. Each speaker is to consider the other equal and is not to employ arrogant language. Each speaker is to be careful to stay on the subject. Each speaker is to try to avoid the use of ambiguous language. Each speaker is to cast no personal reflections. Each speaker is to seek to avoid eliciting demonstrations from the audience. Each speaker is to answer arguments, is to be careful to avoid questioning motives. Each speaker may show the consequence of a doctrine or position, but must not charge the other with believing that consequence unless the other actually does believe it. Each speaker must examine the evidence with fairness. Each speaker must not ridicule, must not threat the other in harmony with, must not treat the other in harmony with the principles of Christian attitude and conduct. And then no new material will be presented in the final negative speech given by each disputant. Note that according to these rules, each disputant may state the issue, define the terms, illustrate points, argue the case, and call for evidence. The format for each night of this debate will be as follows. The speakers will arrive at approximately 6:15. We'll then give each other a series of questions. I believe it's approximately 5 questions. They'll have somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 minutes to answer those questions and give them back to the speakers. And then, beginning at about 7 o'clock, we will have the first affirmative speaker, which will last 30 minutes, followed by a negative speech of 30 minutes. And then we will have a 10-minute break. And following that break, we will have the second affirmative speech lasting 20 minutes, the second negative speech lasting 25 minutes, and then we'll have a 5-minute rejoinder by the affirmative. Now, Before we begin tonight, I do want to say a few words concerning the responsibilities that you as an audience have tonight. I want to mention a few things concerning conduct and concerning our attitude and concerning some things that will be expected of you as an audience. Now, as an audience, you have the responsibility to weigh the evidence that is put before you and to listen to each debater and his arguments and to only accept and only draw those conclusions which are warranted by the evidence. Then make your own decisions about the proposition based on what you've heard and what you have personally studied. We also ask that each member of the audience conduct his or herself in a respectable and in a peaceful manner. Accordingly, we ask that no public display of approval or disapproval be demonstrated or be shown in any form during the entirety of this debate. Thus, we ask that please that you please refrain from clapping or from any voice or noises or any verbal or nonverbal expressions that would indicate your approval or disapproval of the debaters or the arguments that are being made. It is also our desire that you let these two men do the debating. And so therefore we ask that you not engage in any discussions on this topic at the debate site or at its facilities around this building. That you let those debaters do the debating and so that we can have a peaceful intermission period and we'll return to listen objectively to the arguments that are being presented. We also ask that you please be it known that if you become disruptive or choose to violate the audience rules that I've just stated, that you will possibly be asked to leave the premises. Our aim and our desire in this debate is that both sides of the issue be clearly heard and expounded upon in an orderly, systematic, and organized fashion. And so, having said those things, and I hope that you will keep those things in mind, at this time, we want to introduce Brother Roy Deaver. Just mentioned Mr. Deaver will be the moderator for Mr. Mac Deaver, and he will keep the time for the debaters and let I know Mr. Deaver know at the appropriate times when his time is up. At this time, we will begin the debate with Mr. Mac Deaver affirming the proposition. Again, I state the alleged moral atrocities ascribed to the God of the Bible are not actual moral atrocities and therefore constitute no proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. And then Mr. Deaver will be followed by the denial of this position by Mr. Till.
Let me take just a moment to express my appreciation for the great privilege of being with you in this discussion. I appreciate John Moore and the church here in San Marcos and their work through the Bible Chair, and they're making this platform and this location available to us for this discussion. I certainly appreciate Mr. Till's being here and your being here, and I think we are discussing some things of tremendous consequence, and so I will do my best to present this case as properly and effectively as I can. I will be pressing this discussion. I assume Mr. Till will also. I will present my case as firmly as I can. I do not want that measure of intensity interpreted to be are interpreted to mean that I'm being unkind. I don't mean to be. I have nothing personal against him. I trust he has nothing personal against me. Just met him a little while ago. We have corresponded and talked on the phone. But I have no malice for him nor he for me as far as I know. But this is an issue over ideas. This is an issue that is between us, not a matter of personal conflict or animosity at all, nor should it be. But I will present my material and press my case, as so will he. Now, if I can have chart number one, the lights may prohibit your seeing this as clearly as otherwise you would be able to, but I will read this chart, and then I will define the terms that are involved in this chart. And this is our proposition for discussion tonight. The alleged moral atrocities ascribed to the God of the Bible are not actual moral atrocities and therefore constitute no proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. Now, by the word alleged, we simply mean that something has been asserted, something has been declared, but without proof. That's what an allegement is. If you allege something or an allegation, you're giving an assertion without proof or without evidence. So these are called alleged. Moral, I simply mean that which has ethical quality to it, that which somehow has entered the domain of right and wrong, that which has to do with proper or improper conduct. By atrocities, we would mean barbaric cases of wickedness. And then by the word ascribed, these things that are attributed to these cases, or these alleged cases of barbaric wickedness that are attributed to the God of the Bible. By the God of the Bible, we mean the God of creation, of Genesis 1, who claims to have given us His Word and who said He has given us His Son, Jehovah, the God of the Bible. And then actual, we're saying these alleged cases are not actual, that is, they're not legitimate, they're not real, they're not authentic, they're not genuine. Proof, conclusive evidence. These do not constitute proof. They do not give us a compelling or conclusive evidence that the God of the Bible did not inspire this book. By Bible, we mean the 66 books that appear in our canon, from Genesis to Malachi and Matthew through Revelation. By the word inspired, theopneustos, we mean God breathed. We're simply saying that none of the cases that Mr. Till will appeal to are able to do what he thinks they can do. That none of these cases, when properly interpreted and analyzed, could possibly show that this book is not a divinely breathed book. We are saying this is God's book. Now, if we can have chart number two, my obligation in this debate per the writing of the proposition means that all that I have to do in this debate is to show or to prove or demonstrate that Mr. Till has not proven his case. This proposition could have been written in a stronger fashion, but this was satisfactory to both Mr. Till and myself, and so I do not, in this four-night discussion, even have to prove inspiration the way that this is written. I will do that before the debate is over, but I want you to understand the reading of this proposition. The way that it is stated, I do not have to prove that God wrote the Bible. I will try to do that before I'm through, but I don't have to do that in order to measure up to my responsibility. What I do have to do, according to number two, is to prove, or number three, to prove that Mr. Till has no ethical grounds upon which he can disprove the inspiration of the Bible. That's all that the proposition, as it stands written and as agreed upon by him, that's all that I have to do. And then number four, I will point out why his task is an impossible task. I will show why, given the posture that he has taken, and it's not just a new thing with him, I think I understand, he can correct me, for some 25 years now, given the posture that he has attached himself to, I will do my best to show why he is in an impossible situation. These things that get said, and these positions that sometimes are so readily taken and then espoused as though there's just some merit to them, sometimes involve self-contradictions or weaknesses or admissions of defeat, some weakness that is self-condemning. Now, if we can have my chart on the questions. As was mentioned a moment ago, we have agreed that each night at 6:15, he and I will exchange five questions. This is done because it hastens the discussion on. It helps us to focus the attention on the issue at a more rapid speed. And I called your attention to these questions, and I will now consider the answers that he gave me to these questions tonight. These are five true-false questions. Every precisely stated proposition is either true or false. And so, he has, recognizing that these are all precisely stated propositions, answered each one of these true or false. Number one, all ethical concepts, such as good and evil, are empirical in nature. Now, that simply means that when you say something is good or you say something is evil, all you are doing is making some sort of a comment about some sort of material quality. If you say it's empirical, you are saying that it is susceptible to empirical investigation, which means you can find it out or falsify by means of one of the five senses. And Mr. Till, in number one, said this is true. Now, I want you to remember that and think about it very, very carefully. Let it weigh on your mind as we continue this discussion. And as he tries to do, as he tries to falsify inspiration on an ethical platform, he has reduced ethics to physics. That's what he's done. He has said, in effect, that each one of these values, these ethical values, ethics is in the program or the system of axiologies, you know, if you studied just a little bit of philosophy. And he has reduced value, moral value, good, evil. You say, that's a good thing. That's an evil thing. And you're talking about it from the viewpoint of ethics, right and wrong conduct. And he says all of that domain reduces itself to physics or chemistry. You see? That's what he's saying. So when I say that's a bad deed, I have made some sort of a comment about physical properties, not metaphysical properties, not spiritual properties, you see. He's reduced values to the physical, which means that if things go wrong ethically, if they could, what you would need would be a physician, a physician. Just like a physician takes care of your bodily parts and gives you medicine and drugs to help the chemistry of your body, he has reduced the discussion of moral value to that level. So that moral correction comes at the level of physical administration rather than mental or metaphysical discourse, you see, instruction, reproof, correction of that sort. He answered that true. These things are matters of empirical of our value or nature. Number two, another true-false question. A person's knowledge is limited to that which comes to him directly by one or more of the five senses. Well, since Mr. Till is more or less materialistic in his concept, and he is in number one in his concept of values, he says the only thing that he can know is what he has learned via his five senses. He's either tasted it, or he's touched it, or smelled it, or heard it, something of that sort. One of the five senses. That's the only means of contact. Now you say, why is that important to understand? I think it will become clearer as the issue intensifies between us, but it means he cannot call upon testimony. It means he has forever shut himself away from any kind of evidence or proof that has to do with testimony. I'm not talking about inspired testimony. I'm just talking about credible testimony. When he hasn't been there personally, that means the way that he's answered that question, he is forever cut off from literary history. He has no literary historical past. The way that he answers that question, I've seen in another debate that he has had, a written debate, how on occasion he will make use of history when it is convenient to his cause. But when somebody else makes use of some historical document that is against his cause, he would try to take shelter in a false epistemology which limits the possibility of knowledge only to the one of the five senses. But we'll not let that pass in this discussion. But here you have it up front. Now, he's got to be consistent with this or give ground, one of the two, in the discussion. But he's saying he doesn't know anything other than what has come to him directly by his one of the five senses. Number three, I, Pharaoh Till, know that I have a conscience, that faculty whereby I have experienced the feeling of guilt. He answers that question, true. And you don't see that on the chart, but I have it right here before me, and he's got a copy of it. He said that's true. Now, you see the problem that he's already in? What is your conscience? Do you have a conscience? Do you have some sort of aspect of human personality by means of which you have a feeling of approval or a feeling of guilt? Do you have some aspect to your mental apparatus that tells you that's good, you're doing good? Or do you on occasion have that feeling that says, you should not have done that? Everybody here, if we're all old enough, and I think most of us are, everybody here has had a feeling of guilt. A feeling of moral guilt. I should not have said that. I should not have done that. You see? Now, what is the means of that? What kind of a faculty is it? Now, remember how he answered number one. We're all reduced to mud. We all go back to primordial mass, soup, gas, dirt, rocks. And so he says that he knows he's got a conscience, but now his conscience is reducible to the material. It's not metaphysical. It's not spiritual. It's not purely intellectual. It is a physical property whereby he has had this feeling of guilt. I shouldn't get concerned about that at all, nor should you. If it's just simply a matter of chemistry, the way the molecules are arranged in my anatomy, so that on occasion I feel good about myself because I've done right, or on occasions I feel bad about myself because I'm feeling guilty. If it's simply a matter of chemistry and going to the chemist or going to the physician and getting the right drugs to put things back in balance, that's not objective guilt. That's not objective morality, right and wrong. That's reducing the whole thing to the evolutionary level of matter. And that's where he's stuck as far as the discussion of ethics goes. How does he know he's got a conscience? I'll tell you this, he's never tasted it. He's never touched it. He has never heard it. In the sense of, like we use the word here, audible voice. He's never heard it. He's never smelled it. You see, he has not come in contact with what he admits he knows he has. He said a moment ago, the only way he can know anything is by his five senses. Now, I would like to know by which one of those senses he has detected, in fact, his conscience. Now, he says he has had this feeling of moral guilt. By whence did the feeling come? How did you, Mr. Till, get in contact with that information? How did it come? Number four. An absolute objective moral standard exists. He does in this debate, as he did in another debate, a written debate earlier, he says that's false. Now, this becomes so strikingly significant quite early in this discussion. This is a crucial admission to this whole four-night discussion. You see, what he has said in number four, there is no objective standard for right and wrong anywhere. It does not exist. And yet, he has the, if I can call it gall, I don't mean anything unkind about it. I mean the impudence to be in a platform where he's willing to say, even though that's true, somehow God is guilty of a moral atrocity. Now you explain that to me. I'll call upon him to do that. You don't have an objective standard of right and wrong, but somehow, according to Mr. Till, the God of the Bible is guilty of a moral atrocity. How can you possibly have a moral atrocity if there is not an objective moral standard against which you can measure anything? Now, that's where he is. That's where his doctrine is. He takes the agnostic posture. He's not sure God exists. And since he's not sure God exists, he has taken the tact, there is no objective standard, and I do not need that objective standard in order to falsify the alleged inspiration of the Bible. You've got to have more than you've got. You've got to have more than you're willing to admit in order to blame God for anything. You cannot, at one and the same time, say God is guilty of an objective moral atrocity, and at the same time say there is no objective morality. How do you do that? At best you can say God's moral atrocities aren't real atrocities. And that's where I am. Now what will he do about that? Watch and see how he handles that bind that he is in. an absolute objective standard, moral standard exists, and he says it does not. Number five, it is possible that I, Farrell Till, could be wrong in affirming that the God of the Bible is guilty of actual moral atrocities. And as he did in his debate with Jim Laws, he said that's true. I really appreciate these concessions. They're quite handy for me. What that means is the proposition that was read in your hearing just a moment ago, he says he could be wrong about it. He may have signed the wrong one. He's saying that. He's saying, I do not really know that what I'm contending for tonight is true. Now, of course, he thinks it is. I'm not trying to take that away from him. He's attached himself signatorily to the proposition. He means that. That's his conviction. But it also means he is saying, while I contend for it, I have to admit I may be wrong about it. And so much for his questions. Now, chart three, please. Given his agnostic posture, notice the situation Mr. Till is in here then. Up above this line, we have the words, ultimate moral standard, and a question mark. Agnosticism at the top. That's where Mr. Till stands. He is an agnostic. If he wants to change, or if he has changed recently in the way that he considers himself to be regarding these issues, he can tell us. But as far as I know, he still stands there. Ultimate moral standard. There's a question mark. Really, this chart could have been produced in stronger signals or words. But I drew it up before I had his answers to the questions tonight, and so I have to give him the benefit of the doubt when I write the chart. Really, the question mark is not there. The question mark is gone because he's saying there's not one up here. It's not a question of who it is or what it is. In place of the question mark, what you need is the word no. There is no standard up here. Come down below the line where we are now living, the finite human level of action. And we are constantly evaluating conduct. We evaluate each other. Our government does it all the while. We have penitentiaries for people who haven't evaluated according to the laws. We're always doing it. But how do you do it? Now notice Mr. Till's position. He is evaluating moral activity, and this again could have been written stronger, while saying there is no ultimate objective moral standard against which human activity can be gauged. And not only that, he's saying, you have no ultimate standard of morality, but by some fluke, God gets guilty. And how does that work? If there is no absolute moral standard, God, the God of the Bible, in whose defense I stand tonight, can't be guilty of anything. And yet he tries to contend that he knows because there's some things in the Bible that he hasn't figured out, and I say that as kindly as I can, that these things pose problems to him, puzzles to him, ethical puzzles, and since he's not figured out how to balance it in the proper perspective, proper way, that somehow it must be the case that since he hasn't figured it out yet, God gets guilty. Though it's impossible, given the way that he's approaching the whole discussion, it's impossible. That's why we say that he's got a task in this discussion that really has nowhere to go. Now, chart number four, please. Our basic affirmative argument, number one. I hope you can read this. I know it's not as clear, given the light situation. The first premise says, all moral acts committed by the ultimate moral nature are acts with lesser moral nature, such as those had by angels, demons, and men, could not possibly correctly find fault. Number two, X is a moral act committed by the ultimate moral nature. Let X stand for anything in the Bible God did. And during the course of the discussion, he'll call to mind several things that pose problems to him. Let that stand for anything God ever did to the Midianites, the Amalekites, to anybody, the whole of the Canaanite nations, the seven nations. X is a moral act committed by the ultimate moral nature. Conclusion, therefore, X is an act with which lesser moral natures, such as angels, demons, and men, could not possibly correctly find fault. Now, the Bible presents the case
that the ultimate moral nature is God, the Creator. Genesis 1, 26 and 7, it says that we are made in His image. The only way you can possibly have any attachment to or insight into morality is by being in the image of a moral nature. That's the only way ontologically or in the nature of being that could work. Why doesn't your dog have it? Why doesn't your cat have it? Why don't rocks and dirt have it? Why is it that we, of all things on the earth, have the capacity to gather in situations like this and discuss right and wrong? Why is this school, to some degree, concerned about ethics? Why do you have philosophy courses that deal with ethics? Why do students get in trouble for violating rules? Why are there rules? Why are there statutes? Why are there judgments? Why can't we do like we want? And what about that conscience? The only way we can have any attachment to morality in the moral domain is by drawing our nature from ultimate moral nature. And that's what the Bible is saying. And since that is true, you can have some insight into, and so you can have some discussions about, these kinds of questions. Now, any act that's done by this ultimate moral nature, I certainly have the right to evaluate. And I do not criticize Mr. Till for thinking critically, and I mean critically in the sense of scrutinizing, the Bible. I find no fault with him for doing that. I don't call on people to just be dumb with the Bible, be naive with the Bible, be stupid with the Bible, read the Bible but don't think. That's not Christianity. That's not what the Bible says about my responsibility to the Bible. My fault. I find no fault with Mr. Till for saying we must evaluate the Bible. Surely we do. All of us do that. But what I am saying is that since we are made in the image of God, you never can quite get to a point where, beyond your evaluation, you ever can really correctly condemn God. And that's what the Bible is saying about this whole affair. James 4, 11 and 12 is a passage along that line. You can evaluate. In fact, we'll have a chart on it later, but in Genesis 18, even Abraham asked the question on one occasion, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Well, yes, he will, every time. But now that's an evaluative question, and I've got a right to ask that question, and so do you. So I don't put intellectual blinders on myself when I read the Bible any more than when I read the Quran or the Avesta or anything else that comes along, or the Pope's ex cathedra pronouncements, allegedly, or whatever that comes along. No, I am calling for full fairness, intellectual honesty, but I'm saying, when you get into the evaluation of the God of the Bible and all the deeds that He has done, and you're fair with everything that He has done, and given who He is and where we come in the picture, there is simply no way you can quite get to a criticizing posture with evidence. It's always a step beyond what you have a right to do. You never can do that. There will not be one philosophical platform upon which He can call so they can stand there and look down on God and say, guilty. And remember the way He's already answered the questions. He's already at a loss. Because there is no objective way to criticize God anyway. All it amounts to is that the God of the Bible has done some things that Pharaoh Till does not like. And he wishes that he had not done. That's all this amounts to. Mr. Phil and Mr. Till may not like spinach or whatever, or squash. He does not like the way God has done. That's what it comes to. And that's not quite good enough as far as being in a position to prove that God had no right to do what He has in fact done. All right, chart number 17, please. Basic argument 2, agnosticism and ethics. Major premise, all criticism of ethical actions proposed by those that deny objective moral obligation are criticisms that involve their proponents in self-contradiction. Minor premise, criticisms in this debate of God's actions are criticisms of ethical actions proposed by those that deny objective moral obligation. Therefore, criticisms in this debate of God's actions are criticisms that involve the proponents in self-contradiction. Notice, At the end of the chart there, if we can get that in just a moment, chart 17. Mr. Till's predicament is, he says, we know, look at the note right down. No, that's not chart 17. That's okay. I don't have to have it. He is trying to criticize God or condemn God, remember, by the agnostic posture. He doesn't know if God exists. But he does know, he's already said in the answering of our true-false questions, that no objective standard, no objective moral standard exists. So, there is, let X equal objective moral standard. He's already said, there is no X. But now he said, God is guilty of objective, of moral atrocity. I guess he means by that, objective moral atrocity. If he doesn't, he can explain that when he gets up here. If it's subjective, it's much ado about nothing. So, God is guilty of objective moral wrong, but there is no moral standard that God could violate to get in this predicament. And that's where he is. And so, he's got an impossible situation given his agnostic posture. All right? Chart number 5, Kevin, that's all right. Chart number 5. What moral principle known by man has the God of the Bible violated? What moral principle known by man has the God of the Bible violated? Has the God of the Bible lied? Has he authorized others to lie? True, false. This is just for his consideration and for yours. He has stolen, authorized others to steal. If he has that in print in the Bible, then he can call that passage up. He has been guilty of sexual misconduct or has authorized others so to be. Number 4. He has blasphemed his own name or authorized others to blaspheme his name. He has coveted that which is somebody else's or has authorized others to covet. He has demonstrated a lack of respect for legitimate human authority or has authorized others to do that. He has affirmed the existence of other gods or has authorized others to affirm that existence. Or number 8, he has murdered men or has authorized others to murder men. Now think about these questions. What has God done? What ethical principle has God violated that makes him blameworthy for violating moral law? But remember now, according to Mr. Till, there is no objective moral standard. But somehow he gets guilty. Well, what did he do wrong? Did he do any of these things listed in 1 through 8 personally? Did he anywhere from Genesis to Revelation authorize anybody else to do them or any one of them? I know, given what he has said in other discussions, he will come along and try to answer true to some of these, one or two of them at least, and we will respond when he does that. But think about this. He has to be guilty of some wrong. Which did he do? What did he do in order to be criticizable? All right. Chart number 6, quickly. Defining what is morally right. In this debate, I take the position that moral right is whatever is in harmony with the will and nature of God, the God of the Bible. Now, I want to know from Mr. Till, what does it represent? X. X equals what? X stands for what is morally right. I say X equals whatever is in harmony with the nature of God. And the will of God. The Bible teaches the will of God comes from the nature of God. And so I say, whatever is in harmony with the will of God and the nature of God, or the will of God that comes from the nature of God, that's what X is. Now, he denies it. Now, I want to know, since he's criticizing the God of the Bible, what are you going to put there in that question mark? What does X equal? He has to have some answer in order to criticize the God of the Bible. All right, number 8, quickly. Why, this chart is on, why the God of the Bible cannot be immoral. Now, these things need to be thought through. We don't have enough time to go through the chart, but let me simply suggest that if you are the ultimate moral nature, there's not a way, there's not a conceivability whereby you could become immoral. Now, there are certain things God cannot do, and he does not do them. But if you are the ultimate moral principle of the universe, there simply is no way for you ever to become immoral. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Till.